Today we are picking up on some, on a hearing for two different bills that relate to our state parks. And,
The first bill on our agenda today, Mr. Chair, is Senate Bill 66. It would add federally recognized Indian tribes to the list of entities that can receive funds for park and recreation programs from the State Parks and Recreation Department, and it also requires the department to adopt rules establishing standards for the distribution of those types of funds to such tribes.
Okay. For the record, would you give your name?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Janet Tindall. I'm the Assistant Director of Administration for the Parks and Recreation Department.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you. We thought we'd provide a little variety between Tim and I today. So I'm here to ask your support of this bill that, as the committee administrator explained, would allow us to give grants to tribal governments. And these grants would be used for park recreation-type facilities, development, acquisition, enhancement, not for daily maintenance activities. And those facilities would be open to the public. So we have four grant programs, and in the past, only one of those has ever received an application for funding, but we wanted to clarify that we did have that authority, and this was a recommendation of our Attorney General to clarify our statute for that. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Do I have any questions? Representative Gerard.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I guess my number one question is why?
Why? Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard. It's a good opportunity to provide some additional recreation opportunities out there, and we do have this funding available, and we just feel like it's an appropriate use of those funds.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Follow.
The tribes are indeed a sovereign nation. And aren't we giving money to another nation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I believe that's correct. But this would be open to the general public. It would not just be restricted to those members of the sovereign nation.
Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. you indicated that there are several different funds and that might make grants. I'm making a bunch of assumptions when I hear those words. Rather than me making all those assumptions, would you describe those funds to us and what they're for and what the restrictions are on the use of those funds so that, I mean, at this point, I know nothing about, or virtually nothing, about your funding system, except some vague things about Measure 66 and things of that sort. So I wonder if you could amplify a bit on your testimony in the direction I've asked.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart. The first program, and they are listed on the handout that you should have in front of you. The local government grant program is one that is funded with Measure 66 money, the lottery funds, and it is available for acquisition development. This grant is not used for the day-to-day maintenance activities, but to enhance recreation opportunities in the local governments. The Land and Water Fund is from the Federal National Park Service and provides funding for those same kinds of activities, again, not for daily operations. The Recreation Trails Program is also a federally funded program. It actually comes through the TIA 21 money for motorized and non-motorized trails. And the All-Terrain Vehicle Account is actually unrefunded gas tax funds that are dedicated for motorized recreation.
Okay. Follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
Would this bill apply to all of these funds or just to some of them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we would apply it to all of these, and then the tribal governments would compete. All of these are competitive grant programs, and they're scored by a committee representing interest groups that are represented in these committees and or that are part of the recreation providers. And so it would be a competitive process that they would be competing along with everyone else.
additional, if I may. And I think I heard you say in your testimony that there's only been one grant ever made out of these funds?
Mr. Chair.
And the question really is, how come, and have we... I mean, I know some municipalities that would dearly love to have some money for park development. I wonder why they haven't applied.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, there has only been one application. And part of the reason I believe they haven't applied is because they've not been included in the programs before. This would allow them to be included. Why your the local communities have not applied, I can't speak to that, but we'd certainly assist them if they would like to put together an application.
Well, if I may, thank you. The existing law, as I read it, says that you can disperse monies to local governments or other state agencies currently, and that would, I assume, include municipalities like Eugene and Springfield and other local governments like county governments.
Yeah.
Would that be right?
Representative Barnhart, that is correct.
But yeah, they haven't applied.
They may, in fact, have applied. Those communities you've mentioned, I'm sure, have applied and received grants in the past. I'd be happy to provide some information to you on that if you'd like.
I think we're going to hear some more.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart. By the way, I'm Tim Wood, the Director of the Department. I think your question was, when Jenna referred to only one application had been made, she was referring to tribal applications. We have an $8 million program in our local grant program. This year it was $5 million in the two prior bienniums that were all Measure 66 funded. And they are very popular, and we get more requests for the funds than there are funds available. So other municipalities and eligible entities have applied and received benefit of this before. You're just referring to the tribal one.
Ah, thank you. If I may follow up on that.
Please do.
So would you say these funds are already fully subscribed?
Mr. Chair...
Through the grant applications that are already being made?
Generally so. We obligate all the funds in each biennium, and sometimes because projects can't get completed, or there's a matching requirement on the sponsor side as well, that sometimes the projects don't come to fruition, so there's some additional monies available at the end of the biennium, but the funds are, again, highly competitive. I think the point is that it isn't that if we made these grants to tribal governments and included them, that it's to the exclusion of others, because the tribal governments would be very likely applying for projects which would benefit the public as a whole and our partners in providing outdoor recreation activities or facilities and opportunities across the state. So it's not for their exclusive benefit. The public would benefit, as do tribal folks benefit from projects in Eugene and other locations.
Well, thank you. And the original testimony was very puzzling to me, and what you just said clarifies it a great deal. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're showing $8 million here in your testimony from the ballot measure 66 revenue. Where does the rest of ballot measure 66 money go? That you have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, ballot measure 66 money goes to about generally four categories. One is to the local grants program, which is $8 million, and that's our request for 0507. $7 million into an acquisition account for acquiring new park properties. We have a $15 million program that we're asking to increase to $21 million for facility investment, reduction of the backlog, maintenance and repair, and facilities we have in state parks. And then generally the fourth category goes to other operational needs of the operational costs of the department. That's primarily where it goes.
And the other category is plus or minus what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I don't have those numbers with me right now. The total of our lottery funding in this biennium is approximately $70 million. So
70?
Seven zero, right. So with 8 and 7, that's 15 and 21.
You get 34 from million other.
Approximately, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Different topic, if I may. Under this amendment, could these funds be used to support parks that are outside the state of Oregon? I don't mean in Indian lands, but I mean outside the boundaries of the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, no, I don't believe so. I think they're designated for, investment in parks and facilities in the state of Oregon.
And the reason I ask the question is because it doesn't actually say that.
Oh, we wouldn't, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we wouldn't have the authority to expend money for facilities, you know, which aren't covered under the statute or under our rules or, you know, are under our ownership, and therefore that would preclude properties outside of the state.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair.
And American Indian tribes in our state, 9 tribes, and they all have their own casinos, and they're making hundreds of millions of dollars. And why do they need money from this specially dedicated for the park, for the state? I thought they have enough money out of this gambling, and then they're suddenly asking for this park money. I don't know where this comes from. Is the requesting from the American Indian tribes or your own ideas? And where these ideas come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I think the question is really the question of equity, that we afford the opportunity for those who have a need to meet who have recreational needs. The issue is the fact that the tribes might make use of this money in developing park and recreation facilities. Again, I would just make the point that it's for the benefit of the public as a whole and not for the exclusive use of the tribes. So, and the tribes are a partner in providing outdoor recreation in the state. So, specifically as to, I think the reason that this question has come forward was because we wanted to ensure that there was equity in terms of available government entities to be able to make use of these funds in the state.
Okay. I'm not quite convinced yet the equity issue. If it goes to the tribes, what percentage, how much money it will go to the tribe?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, there is no designated amount that is allocated to specific agencies that can compete for these funds. They would compete for the funds just like any other government entity would compete for them. Our project funds are limited for large projects at $500,000, and we have a lower sort of a category for smaller projects, which are $50,000. And so in any biennium, there's competition for those funds, you know, based on whether they're small projects or large projects. So nobody is guaranteed an allocation from or a grant from this program, but all would compete on an equitable basis.
Okay, just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
When we talk about equity, I believe that the Indian tribes, they might have enough money to take care of themselves as a sovereign nation, as they claim it. And there might be a lot of needs, the state parks in our state, always asking for more money, raise the fees when the Oregonians try to get into the parks. They want to continue to charge higher. And I couldn't quite agree on this proposal. That's my comment.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen and Guerrero.
I just had a quick question. You indicated that these are competitive grant proposals, and that some of those awarded grants go unclaimed or unused. I assume there's a carryover to these funds that are unused, and is that carryover in the then category in the same category that we have here, or is it just a general carryover to the ballot measure 66 category, right, group itself?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I think I understand your question. Those funds, all the funds which are made available in this program, if for some reason a project can't get completed, those funds are retained in the program and still made available to local governments and qualifying entities.
Okay.
Representative Curran.
Under the recreational grant programs, the first bullet has for acquisition. In that the tribes, when they purchase land, I'm assuming this acquisition would mean that it would be purchased in the name of the tribe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I would assume so, that if you're talking about purchase of property offside tribally designated property, I would assume that's correct.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
And you would be aware then that when a sovereign nation purchases property, it takes it off the tax rolls for county governments and local governments. So therefore, we would be using taxpayer money to buy land for a tribe to take it off the, as example, county tax rolls. Do I have that scenario correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I understand that when a governmental agency purchases private property, it takes it off the tax rolls. I understand that. I don't know to what extent, you know, tribes, we don't have any experience with this yet, so I don't know to what extent tribes might be interested in using the money for acquisition of property for recreational purposes. I can't answer beyond that.
As a county commissioner in Klamath, I can assure you that's the way it works.
Thank you. Any other questions? I have a few. First of all, you mentioned what happens when a project is under projected cost. What happens if it's over? You have a $500,000 project and it goes to $535,000. What happens in that case?
Mr. Chair, the rules are such that the obligation for increased project costs are the obligation of the soliciting agency. Or
the grant recipient.
Yeah, the grant recipient.
Okay. Secondly, pardon my ignorance, but do the Native Americans pay federal or state income tax? We may hold that for our next testimony.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so, but I can't answer that.
Okay.
But again, this just as a point that this is funded with lottery-funded money as opposed to tax-funded in this case.
I understand that. Where in the bill, I see one textual area in section, I think it's sub 2 under section 1, where does the bill state that the Indian programs funded by these funds will be open to the public?
Mr. Chair, that's part of our agreement that we sign with whoever the grant recipient is at the time that we award the funds.
Okay. Not in this bill, but is
that's
in
correct.
Every contract.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think I will hold the other questions I have then for our next testimony. Anyone else have any questions?
I have just one follow-up that the money you said is from the lottery. The money is not tax dollars, but as I see in here, $8 million from the lottery, but $1.4 million, and $800,000, $6.25, that's all tax dollars.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, on the Land and Water Conservation Fund, that is tax dollars, that's correct. Right, that's federal tax dollars from, actually it's from offshore oil well development is where it comes from, that's correct. In the local grant program, the $8 million program, that is all Measure 66 lottery.
Yes.
Correct.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'll call Lewis Pitt, Jr. Brian, you have someone you'd like to bring with you?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you for coming over.
Yes, sir.
A little away from home.
Yeah. For the record, Louis Pitt, Jr., I'm Director of Government Affairs and Planning. Senate Bill 66, very much in favor of this, and I'll tell you why. Is our tribe is 650,000 acres of lands, and again, nobody gave us those lands. Is that we always held title to those lands given to us by the Creator. And remember what we gave. We gave at Warm Springs 10 million acres to the United States for 13 counties and a number of, on our side of the hill, is major city areas, and all the water and all the resources is that we gave up title to those to the United States, but retained the rights off reservation to fish and hunt. On reservation is that we're struggling like anybody else is when the economy's down, and trying to figure out, as Oregon has learned, is that if we depend on a few resources, and those resources have a life to them and a cycle to them, we have almost roughly half of our reservation's forest, and we have a center of tourism there too called Canita Vacation Resort, and of course now it has a casino there, and we have these parks that do our best to maintain. And we've got a governmental issue here too on reservation, is that I always make a run at this with our Natural Resources Department, because we'd like to see some of our fees from our parks that we charge to folks go to the parks too. No, they have to go back to the general fund, because that's what it's written in the Constitution. So anyway, I get to hear this from our parks people also. Sharing, more sharing that we're doing is we share the Deschutes River, the surface of the river, the fish in those rivers. We have on reservation roughly 40 miles of reservation that people use the surface of, and we have 6 miles of that is shared with non-Indians. And this was one of the first deals we made. This is back when I worked in natural resources about 30 years ago, that we took some dollars. I think it was, I can't remember, I didn't see the paperwork, but it was took some dollars, and we improved that park. And there's 6 miles of fishing that people can do. They have to go through the reservation, have to get a permit, and can do some fishing there. And we also, again, with these off-reservation rights, is that we more of Deschutes River, too. We own 888 acres at the place called Shears Falls, and there's a takeout point there. And I worked with the Deschutes River Plan, Management Plan, and made sure folks didn't get too close to these really dangerous falls. And so we had them take out about 2 miles up above that, which was, again, on tribal property. Both Shears Falls and Sandy River area are tribally owned, and we share those. And we twisted the arm of the BLM to continue helping us out there, and been working with a number of other state agencies, and I'm not sure about particulars of how the plan goes. But, again, sharing. We have Connolly property, again, on the Deschutes, that is called Harfen Flat, that, again, we share with folks that float down there. And on reservation, we have the High Lakes. Rustic is, I think, almost too good a word for how we maintain High Lakes. It's roughly about 25 miles from the community of Warm Springs and about 20 from the nearest paved road. And that, again, we keep those open for tourism. We keep those open. I think, been tradition for us to try to use those as places where we can educate folks. Indian Park on the above the dams on Lake Santustas. Again, a place that needs improvement. We'd like to find some dollars to, again, improve that. 90%, 95% tribal, non-tribal use, pardon me. Again, that Dry Creek Campground was one of our first workings with the state to get those improved. Just an idea of what else on other sharing that we've done is with the Corps of Engineers we have in lieu fishing sites, that the United States is living up to their word, and we have 38 fishing sites, access sites, I get to the river safely. And we're sharing on the Washington side, let's see, what is it, Avery, Sundale, and a place called North Shore. If you're a Columbia River person, you know where those are. But again, three areas that we could have exclusive use of. And we decided, because of our neighbors that wanted to use those areas, and we didn't want to have conflicts with these folks. And again, when I'm around, I remind them about, remember where you got your stuff. Everything you got was from, on that side, would be from the Yakima tribes. And so this has been, I think, a little more than a year of experimentation on that. And so it's worked pretty well. Our folks behave, and they always seem to behave very well unless they're tread upon. And so far, our neighbors, our guests up there, have been using those in, you know, good partnership and sharing with each other. Please keep in mind, as I call him Colonel, he has to work with him on in lieu projects, Executive Director Tim Wood, is I'm an old gorge commissioner, that the access to get on the river is that people travel from Oregon to Washington, Washington to Oregon, to get to the river, depending on how full an area is to get to the river. And same things with campgrounds, is that folks, people coming through will go up and stay at Home Valley, and they usually stay on our side until it's full and such. So we do have, I think, a logical partnership that needs to be looked into with the state of Washington. Another element of sharing, we're working with the state parks with the Wyeth purchase of properties in exchange there to have both Indian and non-Indian benefits there. So we're real proud to have that. So bottom line is that, again, any dollars that we're going to share on reservation and off reservation anyway, and if there's another, I think so, access to some ways to beef those up where they're safer for our neighbors and better designed, disability design type things, is that we're more than willing to partner with folks. I stress to our folks, I'd like to have a life to these, is that just because there's a one-time investment doesn't mean that they're going to have a perpetual fee or access to our rivers and such, is that so we need to sunset this. Well, some of our folks don't agree with that, is that, well, the treaty is not to be taken lightly, is what the federal courts have said about our treaty. And, of course, I've got to live and stay at home, too, and I have some relatives, if they heard me talking about more sharing, is that that's not what they're really into. So we really try to protect our guests and neighbors that come into the reservation. Kenita is 1983. We did a comprehensive plan that said that they were to be the central hub of tourism, commercial tourism for the reservation. And so right now with, I think, the pending plans, and if those things did follow through with off-reservation, a major resort, is that we need to really get serious about what we call sustainable tourism, and of which trying to figure out how to finance and how to, you know, sort of money source all of these ideas. This is one pot for something that I think that we've already got a need for it and a fit for it, and it's a matter of us trying to figure out putting our plan together to then approach the various sources for revenue. So that's where we're at right now, and again, is we're doing our thing as a little nation with rights off reservation, that we do our darndest to protect our way of life. And I thank you, Environment Committee. Thank you, Chair.
Did you want to testify?
Mr. Chair, members of the Environment Committee, for the record, my name is Michael Mason. I lobby for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. What's less known is that I've been an Indian lawyer for over 20 years, and part of that time was in service to the United States in the Department of the Interior, working on environmental issues around the country and being in the lead on making sure that acquisitions of land in trust for tribes by the United States were carried out properly. So I claim some expertise on that, and that includes that some of the tax issues. If I could strive to answer a couple of the questions that were raised earlier. Mr. Chair, you had asked a question about tax payments. All Indian people pay federal taxes.
Mm-hmm.
The tribes are governments, so they don't pay federal taxes. And for their activities on reservation, they don't pay state taxes. And this goes back to Marbury versus Madison, where Chief Justice Marshall pointed out that the power to tax is the power to destroy, and that it wasn't appropriate for the state or federal governments to be able to tax each other because of the battles that would ensue. So that's now been applied, well, for some time, quite some time, been applied to tribes. As far as the individual Indians paying state taxes, they're only exempt from those taxes if they both live on and work on reservation. And many Indians in the state do not do both, so many are subject to those state taxes. And they're certainly, of course, in parks use, they pay the fees like anybody else. But and I imagine they contribute to the lottery, as others do. So that was one question.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. I
was hoping to answer.
Thank you. Representative Garrard first, then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Rep.
I'm well aware that each tribe establishes their own partnerships in their own communities. And I certainly would want to compliment the Warm Springs tribe because they are known throughout the state for their good partnerships and good reputation. So my question is not particularly aimed at your tribe or any particular one, but as a whole. But I have to ask this question. Do you charge anything for a permit to fish or to hike?
Yes.
On reservation land?
Representative Gerard and Chair, yes, we do. When you think about the history that goes with this, the right to hunt, is that that's one of those rights that we had on those lands previous to state, previous to treaty, and the lands, again, too, are lands that are by treaty set aside for our exclusive use. And so both for the I think the protection and matters of safety for our guests, too. We need to figure out where they are and where they aren't. And so, yes, we do charge. And you know, because there's expense incurred about them when they go anywhere, we need to use those dollars to, again, I'd like to say they go right back into the park, but they don't. They go to the general fund and they get a budget probably, I think they said the last time, a third of what they produce. The right to hunt is a privilege, I think, that we'd be giving that right to people to come on our reservation and hunt. And we have right now, that's something that our folks aren't willing to share. So it's an idea that did come up because of we do have just amazing creatures on the reservation because we've set those areas aside, and elk, record size elk, and just wonderful. And areas roughly about 22,000 acres set aside right by Mount Jefferson. And so we've had been approached for folks that would pay a lot of money just for the opportunity to hunt. So again, that's one of those things that, you know, thinking along tourism, is that that's an opportunity that we may, but the big issue is us sharing that exclusive use of said lands. Michael, did you have a chair?
Well, thanks, Louis, Mr. Chair and Representative Grubb. I think when you think about why the tribe charges for hunting, I mean, you start with the treaty basis for hunting, which is for subsistence, to have a homeland on which the members can, you know, survive and make a modest living. And so the preservation of these herds of deer and elk is very important still for people actually eating. So especially today, you know, there's a comment about gaming. The benefits of gaming have fallen to tribes based on location, as you're well aware, and they do not. The tribes don't have, unlike Washington, which has kind of a share of so many machines that can be located in different casinos close to urban areas, Oregon doesn't have that. So a tribe like Burns Paiute, for example, has a small, as you're aware, they have a small casino. They're not making much at all. Warm Springs location at Caneta is not making much at all. So there's not an opportunity to kind of supplement budgets or create jobs in some of these locations. And so Warm Springs is struggling right now with over 40% unemployment, which may come as a shock to some. It's something that was, we couldn't contemplate 5 years ago even. Warm Springs was so successful. I mean, the idea of having 40% unemployment is stunning, but that's the situation now. So it becomes even more important to have that that hunting resource.
One last follow-up.
Take your time.
Would you not feel, since we're talking about Oregon Lottery dollars, mm-hmm. would you not feel that Indian casinos are in competition with the Oregon Lottery?
Well, Chair Anderson and Representative Gregg, the studies that we've done, and you will hear more about the study that was released today here, indicate that there is not that much competition. In most locations, there is not that much competition, that people go to the tribal casinos just as they go to Reno or Vegas for, you know, there are certain people going there for a certain reason, and the people going to gambling at a lottery venue, it's more a neighborhood thing that's So we don't see that much competition. In a couple communities, there's some, and I don't have all those numbers, but we can get those to you. So we don't see a lot. Also, there's been a somewhat, for us, surprising growth in gaming, partly because we're capturing a lot of the dollars that were going to Nevada. People are staying home a lot more to gamble or close to home, and that's benefiting those tribal casinos. That's not money. I think the lottery sees some of that, but a lot of the money that we're seeing was unexpected coming into the tribal casinos is money that otherwise go out of state. So we don't see that much competition. How long it'll continue to grow, we don't know, but we are projecting, with assistance from Echo Northwest, we are projecting growth still for another several years in gaming market.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Jensen.
I hope... Mr. Mason, you weren't really telling us that we have Oregonians who go to Las Vegas.
I don't personally know any representative. My family always went to Reno, so I don't know about Las Vegas.
Mr. Chair, my question, I get back here to it. And apologize for the digression, and apologize to my very good friend from the representative from Las Vegas that joins us on the committee here.
Apology accepted.
the issue I guess that I was looking for and I need a clarification. I'm not sure that I understand, all of the structure of the Warm Springs tribe. But I know the Umatilla, on the Umatilla Reservation, there's a lot of land that is non-Indian owned. Is that a similar situation if on the Warm Springs Reservation, or is that all tribal owned?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen is... we're real proud of Warm Springs is that a lot of the tribes are 50%, 55% at best. Upriver, I think Grass Purse is like 15% tribally owned or controlled. Warm Springs, 99%.
And part of the reason for the inquiry of that question, which then isn't really apropos as far as the Warm Springs are concerned, but might be as far as some other tribes. I know with the Umatilla, there's always been kind of there recently has been a move to try to repurchase when and if they, where and if they can, the lands of their reservation so that it comes back underneath of the, full umbrella, I guess, if you want, of the tribe. And I appreciate that probably a lot of that land is not land that would be necessarily park, quote-unquote, type related, But I can also appreciate, having been up in the, you know, up the Umatilla River, that there's some very nice spots that one could have a park up there that are on the reservation but are not, I know, not tribally owned. And would it be your interpretation that then, or your understanding, if a bill like this were to go through, that this that they might apply for a grant to repurchase those lands to put them in a again a park situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's a I'm a Warm Springs representative. I would guess that our brethren up the way would, again, they're sophisticated at what they do, and I think that the strings attached would be weighed, you know, just the business approach and figure that out. And if it, maybe its highest use is something of tourism, that, yeah, sure, it could be used as such. Mm-hmm. But again, it would be their decision and their future to figure that out.
I can follow just a little with editorializing more than anything else. I think, you know, they do make something of a, as they should, I believe, a play on the salmon walk. You know, a park somewhere on the Umatilla having to do with that, if it happened to be, you know, where the spawning salmon were visible, could be quite an attractive, small, touristy type of thing. So, just a point of curiosity, you know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Just a question or two. Thank you for answering the question regarding income tax. One other question, that is, I haven't had the chance, the opportunity to work with the Warm Springs tribe. We have in Grants Pass been able to work with the Rogue Indians at the Seven Feathers, and they've been very generous in a number of areas, not necessarily in parks and recreation, but more in economic development, and we appreciate that very much. But let me just ask maybe a naive question. We have two sovereign nations, a number of them, but yours and the United States of America. And if we are giving monies to the sovereign Indian nation, what would be the expectation that we might have that the Indian nation might be giving to parks and recreation in our nation? Is there any chance at some point where profits are good at your casino or you're doing well that you would invest in our state?
Chair Anderson, this is only philosophically, I would say yes, is that I think as neighbors with the limited land base, with the land that for us is our approach has always been take care of the land. And if you have land that's dedicated for recreation or tourism, is that it has to be able to take care of itself, and then from that point it can benefit the users, of which it'd be both Indian and non-Indian in any case. Is a, I see down the road this crystal ball type thing, that one of the big problems that we have is folks really don't understand our sovereignty and how it differs from state sovereignty or United States sovereignty. And so these shared use type areas really are great opportunities for us to get our message across. So we would, I think wealth is a relative term that, again, we feel like we've given a whole heck of a lot to the state of Oregon with the land and the waters, and money is just one of the wealths that I think people need to look at. We as Americans, you know, it's a part of it. We're, even our poor folks, is that when back when I was living supposedly in the ghetto, is that I wasn't living in a ghetto. That was home, and we were poor, but cash poor. We had land and resources and food on the table and such. And that kind of philosophy is the type of thing we'd like to have different opportunities to share, not just here, but these parks do really represent, with interpretive signs and with signage and lectures now and then, is an opportunity to just share who we are. So, yes, is that, again, I think that's the direction we're headed in this country, is that we're going to have to do more to partner and help each other.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, briefly to that answer, as Mr. Pitt has said, we're representing the Confederate Tribes of Warm Springs. I was at one point general counsel for 8 years, for the Confederate Tribes of the Grand Ronde, and wrote the bylaws for the Spirit Mountain Community Fund and was involved in the initial grants from that fund. And the generosity of that fund and those of other tribes is well known in the state. A good amount of that money has gone to local governments. I can't say how much has gone to parks, but it's certainly available for that if grant proposals are made. So there is an opportunity with gaming dollars giving back right now. And as Mr. Pitt has said, that's hypothetical, but I would expect that to happen from the Warm Springs side as well.
Mr. Chair, we'd hope to get to that point where we could help you folks out.
That goes two ways.
Yeah.
I just taking the prerogative of chairman at the expense of possibly boring my committee, I'd just like to thank you because I think the philosophy you just stated, that you may be cash poor but land rich or spirit rich, is very important to our nation. Mm-hmm. And I've heard it said that poor is not dirty. Mm-hmm. Poor is not a lot of things. And I'm afraid that we have a number of people from every tribe and nation that have a poorness in spirit, that don't have they're looking for cash, but what they really need to be looking at is the spirit that you mentioned. The other comment I'd like to make along the lines of what Representative Jensen said, and that is, I think every Oregonian would be excited if you were just building land within the tribal boundaries, for instance, on the Umatilla, to build parks. That I think we'd be more than excited as that develops, because it would be open to all Oregonians, not just your tribe. Thank you both for coming. Michael,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
And appreciate you being here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Before you go, I see we have a representative of the Umatilla, lobbyist for the Umatilla here, and I don't know whether she has anything to particularly add, but I was wondering if I might leave her with a question to respond to, or to find out about the issue of the Umatillas and the whether there's would be any intention, desire, what have you, to use this grant sort of thing for the repurchase of tribal lands on the reservation that are currently owned by non-Indians, and again under the confines of the park.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for suggesting that.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, my name is Kelsey Wilson, and I represent the Confederated Tribe of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and I do not have a prepared testimony. I was just ordered to come and listen. I do know that the tribe supports this bill, and I will definitely go back and find out some more information from them and what their intentions are.
And, Mr. Chair,
hello?
It's perfectly okay with me if she tells her boss that he owes her.
Thank you, Representative.
Saw your boss coming in and out.
Yes.
All right, thank you very much, Kelsey. Hearing no other questions, I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 66, and we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 68. Staff?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 68 would allow the State Parks and Recreation Department to issue permits for the operation of Class 1 terrain vehicles on the ocean shore, but only for specific purposes. These purposes would include use by persons with disabilities, use by emergency response or emergency aid workers, or biologists, wildlife monitors, or other types of natural resource workers. There's a second element to the bill that would allow the department to issue permits for pipelines, cable lines, or other types of conduits across state recreation areas.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Tim Wood. I'm the director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And as previewed here, this Senate Bill 68 really has two separate components. They're not necessarily interrelated. There's two changes in this request, in this Senate bill, for request to make changes to the statute. The first portion regarding a change in the language that conform the two different pieces of language in the existing statute that would allow us to issue permits for putting pipelines and conduits and so forth under the Ocean Shore Recreation Area. I think what happened was when the statute was written, there was an unintentional conflict written there, where one said prohibits and one allows under the ocean shore. Inserting the words recreation area into the statute will clarify that. Fact of the matter is we do issue permits now for conduits. It's not practical to put a conduit or a pipeline under the ocean shore without also going under the ocean shore recreation area. So this is just to clean up the language in the statute. The second portion of this bill, as mentioned, would allow the department authority to issue permits for all-terrain vehicles to operate on portions of the Ocean Shore Recreation Area. Currently, by statute, they are not permitted to do so. Those portions of the Ocean Shore which are open to driving for vehicles are open for driving of street-legal vehicles, and Class 1 ATVs do not meet that criteria. The purpose of doing this, allowing the department to adopt rules to allow ATV, Class 1 ATVs on the ocean shore, would provide opportunities to disabled and elderly folks as, to enjoy the beach experience, as well as give us some legal authority to allow ATVs for use for sort of maintenance and operational purposes, natural resource management purposes on the shore. As a result of adoption of this portion of this bill, our commission would go to rulemaking to adopt rules that would govern the issuance of these permits and how they would be administered. It is generally the current thinking of our commission right now that permits would only be issued for vehicles for on areas of the ocean shore which are currently open to driving. So it wouldn't expand the portions of the ocean shore that are open to driving now. It would just be limited to those portions of the shore that are open to driving by street legal vehicles. So thank you for the opportunity to comment. I'm not sure if I clarified that. Probably my text did it better than I did, but I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Gennaro Carrard.
Director Wood.
With no beaches in Klamath County.
Not that I know of. Will you charge fee these permits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, probably not. They would be people who would be eligible would be those who are disabled who have the DMV certification or the DMV card that would designate them, and we would issue them as a no fee permit.
Thank you.
Actually, I apologize. You probably do get some nice beaches on either Agency or Klamath Lake.
We do. Yeah. Well, not exactly sandy beaches.
But swimmable.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
So, Mr. Wood, how many people will be affected? Do you believe those people who has disabled the parking permit, are they able to drive in that area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, certainly the total number of folks that would be available, would potential users, would be those who have the disabled permit. But there's a much smaller subset of those people who are beach users and who also have access to Class 1 ATVs. So I really can't give you a number. What I can tell you is our experience over the last couple of years is there's an increasing interest from elderly and disabled folks that live along the ocean shore to have access that this would provide. I know that number is I know there's a lot of interest out there because we get inquiries very frequently.
Yes, Steph.
I just thought of this question just as you were speaking. Under your scenario, could an individual set up a business, if you will, to provide access? using Class 1 ATVs to provide access to the beach to persons with disabilities? Or are you viewing this as just being something that the individual would do?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hauser, we were looking at it as an individual request. I suppose the possibility of somebody establishing a business to provide that service to the disabled is possible. I really hadn't thought of that.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at Section 3, and I think Sub 2, Lines 27 and 28. I think the section before that requires that you have a driver's license. I assume that's what those other ORS sections are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that refers to the statute that requires permits for operating Class 1 ATVs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anywhere at all?
Correct.
Anywhere in the state. Okay. So the second piece of that says if the vehicle will be used to meet the transportation needs of, and then the subsections are disabled people, emergency response, and scientists, basically. The thing I'm wondering about is, have we established a hole here that I have a vehicle and I want you to give me a permit to, because it will be used by to meet the transportation needs of a disabled person, but I'm also going to use it for a whole bunch of other things in that area. Is this language tight enough so that it's clear that your purpose is going to be met, which I understand to be, if I get the permit to meet the transportation needs of a disabled individuals with disabilities, that's what I'm going to use it for, and not for something else at all times when it's in these areas that are otherwise restricted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's a good question. The way we would address that is in rules. We would adopt rules that would help us govern how those vehicles are actually used. The intent would be to provide access for enjoyment in the ocean shore recreation area to disabled and elderly folks who need that access, and we would need to address in our rulemaking process how we would manage that to ensure that those who had permits weren't using it for other purposes. If that answers your question.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, I think it does. I think what your intent is then that I should get a permit if I'm going to transport my disabled mother in this area to drive one of these vehicles, assuming I have the other permits that I need. But I couldn't then use that permit to take my grandchildren out who are not disabled.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gerard.
I'm just kind of following up earlier. You said when I asked you about charging fees for these permits, your answer was probably not. But in the bill under Section 3 on line 5, it specifically says the manner in which the permit must be displayed and the fee, if any, for a permit issued under this section. That would indicate to me that you have the option to charge a fee or not, but the fee is in the bill, so therefore you could charge the fee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I believe I see how you're reading that, and I would agree with what you said. Again, our intention is somewhere in here. It talks about how the department would adopt rules to do this, and it's currently not the intent that to charge a fee for that permit.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
and I understand that, Mr. Whitten. As long as you were there, I know that you would keep your word, but this bill may outlast you.
No.
Perhaps. Thank you.
Mr. Woody, you mentioned that this vehicle will be driving around the recreational area. What's the definition of a recreation area? It is not all public beaches. It's a special areas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, by statute, the Ocean Shore Recreation Area is defined as from the ordinary low tide line to the west, inland to either the statutory line, which has been surveyed, or the vegetation line, whichever is furthest inland. So the term recreation area or ocean shore recreation area and the jurisdiction of our department on the ocean shore is confined to that definition.
Okay. So which means it is not all areas, it's a confined area there. Certain confined area.
State beach.
That's correct.
Or state beach.
Correct.
So in other words, they can go anywhere in the state beach.
Mr. Chair, Representative, only in areas that are currently open to driving by statute now and by rule. If certain portions of the ocean shore are open for normal street legal vehicles to drive on. Sometimes it's closed certain times of the year. And there are portions of the ocean shore recreation area which are not available at all for driving on. And so this would be limited to the areas which are open for vehicle driving.
So follow up. So there is a clear sign there, certain beaches is open for driving, and up to this line, do they have a clear lines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, that's correct. The beaches are posted at the accesses to say, you know, north of this sign is, you know, off limits to vehicles. South of the sign, vehicles are permitted. It's also annotated in. On the Oregon State, on the Oregon Department of Transportation highway map is indicated down the left-hand column as to what portions of the beaches are open and which are closed.
Thank you. I think you've answered several of my questions, that there are actually roadless and then also drivable areas of State Beach. Could you go over just a little why they're roadless? Is it because of petroleum or other things that are dropped or tearing up the beach? Or
Mr. Chair, that predates me, but my understanding is that back when our commission has the authority to adopt rules which govern which parts of the beach are open to driving and which aren't. And we, since I've been here and since 1998, we haven't had addressed these issues. Haven't come before the commission, but at some time in the past, there was a considered decision on the part of the commission as to which areas would be open and which would be closed. And if I'm not mistaken, some of that debate was a result of protecting natural resources, providing areas for more solitude at the beach, and so there wasn't competition, with other types of vehicle recreation, and also at the request of municipalities and other government agencies in terms of controlling, vehicle use on the beach. For example, say right in front of Lincoln City would be an example.
I question why we have biologists, wildlife monitors, and other natural resources in there. Is there a difference between a roadless beach and a roadless forest? Where you can't take a motorized vehicle into a roadless forest.
Mr. Chair,
I understand fully the disabilities. I understand the emergency response. I think that's wise. But
Mr. Chair, the purpose of that for resource management use is if you're doing like wildlife inventories, habitat monitoring, assessing damage, those kinds of things. I'll be honest with you, we have been allowing that to happen, but we haven't had actually the authority to do that because these are not street legal vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And this would just confirm that it's okay to use those vehicles for those kinds of purposes. Where it's, you might enter the beach and you have, 5 miles worth of beach that you need to monitor or inventory or something, it's just more practical purposes.
I understand that, but it seems like it's letting one elite group use it and the public not be able to use it. and that bothers me in principle. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Wood.
Thank you.
And if there is no other question, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 66. 68. We'll close the bill on Senate Bill 68. And hearing no other agenda, we are adjourned.